Yes, hello folks, welcome to a special episode of the Global Football Show. I'm your host as always, Phil Pratt, joined with my regular co-host, the excellent Zach Lowy. Don't forget you can find Zach at BTL, Breaking the Lines, his fantastic website, and at Zach Lowy, joined with the excellent Ollie Kay from The Athletic, who's been a regular on this podcast now for 10 years. He's aging better than I am, the looks of things. It's always good to have him on. It's always grateful to have his time. Lots of stuff to talk about, of course, with some of the news it's making, some of the news in the Premier League and beyond. So great to have him on the podcast. Ali, how you doing, my friend?
Very good, thank you.
Very, very good. Great to have you on. I'm going to be biased since I'm a host here and start with a Manchester United question because they have Brighton tonight in a very, very, very difficult game. As a United fan, it's a game I would take a point in without a doubt. It's a difficult game away to West Ham. Liverpool, somewhat on their coattails, who have had a decent run of form, unbelievable game against Spurs at the weekend. Maybe a bit lucky against Forest too. Can't defend, but nonetheless, you look at their remaining fixtures, you would think they're all winnable. Leicester away might be tough. I think you probably need another 4 points to secure that top four. Brighton, you know, when I watched them in the cup semi final, and I've haven't beaten Brighton in a while, and they've done them at the Amex. I haven't beaten them a season. On penalties, and they beat them at Old Trafford. It is a model football club in the way it's run. Part of me looks at Brighton's midfield and it perturbs me a bit, especially when I see Caicedo, which United could have had. Brilliantly coached football club, brilliant football club, very difficult away fixture for a team who themselves are still in with a bit of a shout. What are you expecting, Nate?
Really hard to say, isn't it? I mean, it was interesting going into that FA Cup semi-final, which was, 10, 11 days ago. I think Brighton were the bookmakers' favourites for that game, which was amazing, considering United are a hugely successful club. They've had a good season, won the League Cup, of course, done well in Europe till the Sevilla game, fourth in the league, and it's not like last season. And yet Brighton were favourites, and Brighton were the better team, I think, for probably an hour or so, or at least the first half of that semi-final. United's experience and resilience, I think, told in the end in terms of getting them to the extra time and then getting them through extra time and then winning on penalties. It's a bit of a revenge mission for Brighton. I think they've probably got more at stake in terms of they're desperate to qualify for Europe. They're desperate to get into the top four if they can. United have got a lot more margin for error. United are potentially creaking a bit in terms of injuries, particularly in defence. I think it's a really interesting game. One thing I'll predict is that Brighton will have an awful lot more possession. And Brighton will probably get much more praise for the way they play technically and tactically. And to be honest, I've been impressed by a lot of what United have done under Ten Hag, but to me they're still sort of, they've been at their best this season when they've sort of reverted to that almost Solskjaer Mourinho kind of blueprint of being hard to beat and being solid in the middle and counter-attacking. I don't think they're yet anything like a Ten Hag team. So they've got into this position where they're well capable of getting top four. They look like they're going to get top four. And I think the sort of technical evolution of the team is probably going to come next season. But that's a very long-winded way of saying, I don't know what to expect tonight. But I think even if Brighton win, and which would put them, I'm just looking at the table now, which would put them 8 points behind United with a game in hand. It would put them into sixth place. It would put them hot on Liverpool's heels. I think top four is done, in my opinion. I mean, even if Liverpool win all their games and with that great goal difference they've got, they're not going to overhaul United, I don't think. United have got quite a cushion, haven't they? So
the rules in front game at home, I would expect them to win.
I quite fancy Brighton in this particular game, but
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Oliver. I think that top four is done and dusted. But one thing that most certainly is not is the relegation battle. We saw a really interesting relegation six-pointer on Monday at the King Power between Leicester and Everton. Really exciting end-to-end match. Leicester going from almost going down 2-0 to on the precipice of going up 3-1. I think they'll be kicking themselves for not getting the 3 points because this game was there for the taking against an Everton side that has struggled. And ultimately, just a lot of regrets, a lot of what ifs. What if Daniel Iverson, who in my opinion was man of match, had been starting from the start of the season in goal instead of Danny Ward? What if Jamie Vardy was taking that penalty against James Maddison? Mm-hmm. So obviously it's been a very disappointing season for the Foxes. What do you think has gone wrong for Leicester? And do you see them just about staving off relegation?
I do. I mean, it's very, very close down there. They're 16th, but they're still level on points with Nottingham Forest. There's only goal difference separating them from the relegation zone. And they've got quite a few tough games coming up. Fulham away, Liverpool home, Newcastle away, West Ham at home. But I think I would expect Leicester to win at least one of them. I don't know which. Maybe it's Fulham away on Monday and then they can breathe and relax. But even if it comes down to the final weekend of the season against West Ham, I do think they will win one. I think they have picked up a bit under Dean Smith, I think. And I think even if Brendan Rodgers was still there and he was, you know, I think with hindsight, you know, I really rate Brendan Rodgers, but with hindsight, I think he probably could have done with moving at the end of last season or even the season before. I think things have gone a bit stale for him there and for them. But I think even if he was still there, I've always felt Leicester would just about have enough to stay up. I think they've been pretty awful this season, and there are so many small factors or micro factors, like, you know, the Danny Ward, Daniel Iverson one you mentioned, and injuries and that penalty miss the other night, and, you know, individual errors by the dozen in defence. And it's just been this general thing of a bit of a malaise at the club, sort of post winning the FA Cup and missing out on the top four a couple of times. And, you know, I think generally things have declined a bit. The ownership seems a bit less engaged. They haven't really invested as much in rebuilding as other clubs have. So I think they've kind of gone backwards a bit, but I think they'll stay up. I think even if they only sort of, I don't know, get a couple more points this season or two or three more points, I'm still not certain that Forest and Everton and Leeds are all going to get enough points to stay up. So I think Leicester will be okay. I thought their performance the other night was probably encouraging in some ways, a bit alarming in other ways because their defending was poor, but it showed that there's probably enough individual quality and energy in that team to win another game.
It brings me to Everton, Ollie, because it's a massive football club. Huge. And they've spent enormous amounts of money under Mascheri. And you can go back to Brands, Koeman, still hard to believe they had Ancelotti there a couple of years ago. And yet here they are. And for the second season in a row, they're in serious, serious trouble. I watched that game against Leicester. They did show some fight. They look awful defensively. They are in real, real trouble and could go down, with FFP also hanging over their head. One, do you think they'll go down? And two, if they did, what do you think that would mean for the football club?
I mean, I think it's actually easier to answer the first question than the second. I think they are seriously, seriously vulnerable. That's probably a statement of the obvious when they're 19th with four games left. But just looking at the fact that they're a point behind the other three, and the fact that their next two games are Brighton away and Manchester City at home. They could easily lose those two. Wolves away, not easy. I think a lot of people are looking at that last game and thinking, well, if they need to win that to stay up, then, you know, that Bournemouth at home on the final day, that looks winnable in the same way that I remember a game against Wimbledon in 1994, you know, on the final day, which kept them up. That looked winnable. That looked like a safety net. But if they're not careful, if they don't pick up some points in the next three games, they could be down by then. They could be down going into the final game. It's a really precarious situation. I thought they played well the other night. I thought it was the best they've performed in weeks, really. And I think they looked like, I mean, looking at those two teams on Monday night, you thought, how are these teams at the bottom? And the answer is, they haven't played that well this season in the main, neither of them. And B, the standard is really, really good. I know you get every season people go, oh, the standard's crap because, you know, so-and-so, you know, have been useless and they've underperformed and they're still fifth or they're still sixth. And, you know, people will dismiss the quality of the teams at the bottom, quality of the teams in the middle. The Premier League is incredibly strong, as it should be, given the money at stake, given the money involved and the fact that they're hoovering up sort of all the best players from all over Europe. But I was looking at that game the other night thinking, how are these two teams, you know, how have they been so poor all season? But, you know, Everton have been, and they've been poor for two seasons, really. If you have to ask me right now, before the weekend's games, I would say, yeah, I think they probably, it's a bit of a coin toss, but I certainly don't give them a better than 50-50 chance.
So tragic.
Bring up. And every Everton fan I speak to, and I know many of them, they fear the worst. They think this is the time. So they've got to pull the performance out. And as the second part of the question, how, you know, what will happen to the club if they go down? I mean, if they stay up, the future suddenly will seem a lot brighter because they've got the new stadium coming around the corner. I was there not long ago, taking a look from the Dock Road. It's going to be a really good stadium. It looks really good. It's almost surprising that after all the sort of, you know, stadium projects that have been aborted over the years, that it's surprising to see it's actually happening. But they could be in the championship. They could be in the championship for a long time if they're not careful. They could do a Sunderland or a Sheffield Wednesday and drop further because, as you say, financial fair play and so on. If they stay up, they will be, I think, clear of some of the historic overspending which has restricted them FFP-wise the last two seasons. They might be able to have a bit more freedom in the transfer market. But if they go down, I mean, they are... Well, they would desperately have to clear the wage bill because the wages are massive. You know, they've overpaid massively in terms of wages on Premier League income. There will be players there on money that is completely unsustainable in the Championship. And I don't know, you know, say they were to sell Calvert-Lewin and Pickford and... one or two others, Iwobi, Onana. It would clear some of the debt, and it would make it easier to make ends meet. But then you would think, well, are they going to have enough quality to come back up again? And then there's the fact that, you know, the Football League, the EFL, are much, much stricter on financial mismanagement than the Premier League are. So if they're not careful, they could be in real bother. And they haven't been careful. That's, you know, the fact is they've been far from careful over the years, which is why they're in this situation.
I do wonder if we could see potentially a derby situation with Everton. I think that, you know, as much as they need a wake-up call, I don't know if that's relegation, they most certainly need a wake-up call I do worry for them far more than any other team in the Premier League in case of relegation. Everton currently 1 point behind Nottingham Forest, Leicester, and Leeds United, who have replaced Javi Gracia with Sam Allardyce. Gracia, a bit unlucky, but it is hard to justify staying in charge after you lose 4-1 to Bournemouth. Oliver, we've gone from Marcelo Bielsa to Jesse Marsh, now all the way to Sam Allardyce, kind of like going from one end of the spectrum to the other. But what have you made of this decision to appoint Allardyce?
I know Sam Allardyce very well. I've known him for more than 20 years since he was at Notts County, and I was a young reporter at the Nottingham Evening Post. I have a lot of affection for him, respect for him, and I will defend his managerial career against anybody who dismisses him and say, "So, oh, he's a long ball merchant or never won anything." He's had a brilliant managerial career. I think he's over improved and probably exceeded expectations at every club he's managed, apart from Newcastle, where he was only there a short time. But I don't think he would mind me saying, or anybody saying, look, it's an appointment made out of complete desperation on Leeds' part, because they are terrified of relegation. They were desperate when they sacked Bielsa back in, what was it, February last season. I think they were relegation waiting to happen at that point, because they were not only losing games, it wasn't just like a couple of bad performances, they were suddenly just looking clueless and rudderless. And I can understand why they made that painful decision to sack Bielsa. I think they would have gone down otherwise. And I think Jesse Marsh gets not enough credit for keeping them up in the short term. But as with like Frank Lampard taking over Everton, it was a sort of firefighting job, which he kept them up. And then the problems set in again early the next season. And I think, once again, they've seemed like a relegation waiting to happen. Slight bounce when Javi Gracia came in. But, again, the last few weeks, conceding so many goals at home to Crystal Palace and Liverpool, was 11 goals over those two games. And, it's felt like they are just going to keep losing. So you become desperate. You think, well, who can we get? 4 games to go. What do we need? We need to stop losing. Who's good at that? Sam Allardyce, basically. That's what he does. But he's normally come in. I was looking at the stats for a piece yesterday on The Athletic, but he normally comes in around November, December for these salvage jobs. And normally, Blackburn, Sunderland, West Ham, Crystal Palace, he's always sort of come in and bought, had at least one transfer window and strengthened and got different types of players. And any kind of soft touch club, he's always brought in stronger physically imposing players that can play his kind of football. In this situation, he's got to try and play his sort of survival football, his sort of back to basics, clean sheets, keep it tight football with a group of players who, look, have been assembled with a view to the kind of Red Bull model of resaleable players, development players, young players who are suited to sort of playing, should be suited to playing sort of fast tempo football, which they've not done brilliantly this season. And Allardyce plays a completely different type of football. So I don't know how he plans to turn it around with bring his ideas to a completely different group of players. And they've got Man City away, followed by Newcastle at home, West Ham away, Tottenham at home. It's a really tough run of games again. So Leeds, Everton, Forest, I don't see many points being picked up by those three this season. So one of them is clearly going to survive, because I think Southampton are gone, but it just looks desperate for the other three. And you know, somebody's going to probably scrape a win and a draw and stay up, and Leeds will desperately hope it's them under Allardyce.
Big Sam gets typecast a bit as the old-fashioned British manager, is an up-and-out-of manager. But I think that's really unfair because, if you look at Big Sam over the years, Big Sam was embracing methods way decades ago that he took from the US. He took from US sports. He's quite a methodical guy that embraces lots of different ideas from lots of different sports. He was mocked a bit yesterday for his press conference, but even if Leeds go down, I would keep Sam, and I don't think that it's fair that he gets typecast a bit as an old-fashioned, British manager with old-fashioned, tactics of long ball. I mean, he's actually quite a bright guy.
Oh, he's a very bright guy, and people. I mean, I tweeted about it. I was amused by what he said about Klopp and Guardiola and being equal to them, and people react. People, I think people think, does he really believe this? And look, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, but I think it's largely being said for the benefit of his players, so that they kind of buy into this idea that we've got, somebody who really backs himself, knows what he's doing, which he does. And it's he's certainly bright. And the thing is, he was being dismissed as, old-fashioned and prehistoric dinosaur, etc. in the 2000s when he was at Bolton, when he was very modern. But you're never very modern and progressive for long in football. And you can, like, Arsene Wenger was sort of modern and progressive, the most progressive and pioneering manager the Premier League's ever seen, perhaps, in 1997. But 20 years later at Arsenal, he had begun to seem like, somebody who was, or even 15 years later, he'd begun to be seen as somebody who's stuck in the past. My concern with Allardyce, as well as the sort of, whether those players are compatible, is that, I mean, he's only worked 6 months in 5 years since leaving Everton. And I don't think he was prehistoric or stuck in the past at Everton. I think he was, I think he played a kind of football which Everton fans said they didn't like, but I think they probably preferred it to most of what's come subsequently. But I think the way the game's changed over the last 10 years or so, I think he is, I think he is very old-fashioned compared to, most of the managers now, most of the coaches, most of the, when he was at West Brom, their sort of pass completion was way below the rest of the Premier League because he was playing a much more direct style, which nobody really plays anymore. You might say, I mean, who would you call a direct team these days? There's nobody really in the Premier League. Sean Dyche was accused of it at Burnley, but it was certainly not direct compared to, the teams in the 90s or the 2000s. But he's going to go there and probably rely on his, the old-fashioned sort of back to basics approach that he has is exactly what Leeds feel they need to buy into for these few games to become hard to beat again. And so I would say he's always been modern in some ways. He was always ahead of the curve in some ways in terms of analysis and all the sports science and things that he was doing in Notts County in the 90s, never mind at Bolton in the 2000s. And I think now, probably because everybody does all of those things, he's probably not coming in with new ideas at all this time. But maybe it's that sort of, maybe now, the way things are now, maybe the completely compact defending and being so tight at set pieces and not wanting to take any risks in possession in the, you know, in their own half, maybe that will suddenly seem very, very novel and very new, and you know, a change. Maybe it can be what keeps them up. I don't know.
Oliver, another team that is suffering a dismal run of form at the moment is Chelsea Football Club. That's now six straight defeats since Frank Lampard took charge. And honestly, I was watching their game against Arsenal, and it looked like when your teacher, you know, got a sickness or injury, and they brought in a long-term substitute, and all he'd do is put in a movie for you to watch, you know. That's what it felt like. It was honestly taking me back to high school, because these players, they look like they're on vacation. They look like they've caught the senioritis bug or whatever, and they just want to put their feet up and relax. You know, whenever they would lose the ball, there was no intensity, no structure to win it back. And, you know, as much as Lampard has done a terrible job as interim coach, he is far from the biggest problem at Chelsea. The fact is, a lot of these players are not good enough. A lot of them don't have the right mentality. There's a distinct lack of physicality, of a goal-scoring striker. So many issues at Chelsea. How do you fix a problem like Chelsea Football Club?
I think Chelsea are just desperate for the season to end and just put the whole thing behind them. But I think they felt like that almost from, I don't know, it's like Chelsea didn't come back from the World Cup break. I think they're it's six defeats on the trot, which is terrible. Look, let's be clear, it's terrible under Lampard. But I think they've only won, and I apologise if the stat is wrong, but I think they've won four Premier League games out of 22. And who were those wins against? Let me have a look. Leeds 1-0, Crystal Palace 1-0, Bournemouth 2-0, Leicester, when Leicester were, you know, at the nadir, 3-1. It's been terrible for, I mean, there was a brief, you know, Potter actually started pretty well, you know, as much as we might forget that now, but it's been terrible all season. It's got worse. I felt, and I've been derided for tweeting when, look, I wasn't in favour of sacking Tuchel. I thought that was stupid. I wasn't in favour of Potter, because I thought even if there was, they were to conclude, look, he isn't the man for the long term, I felt like they should still have just sort of stuck by him for the rest of the season. But having done that, I felt it made some sense, and it's the only thing I've said made sense that Todd Bowley and co have done since they bought the club a year ago. I thought it made some sense to have Lampard there as an interim and just be able to look for, you know, work on the appointment of the long-term replacement without the pressure of sort of, you know, needing to rush that. So I thought that kind of gave them some breathing space and time, and it just hasn't worked. But the problems at Chelsea are far deeper than, I mean, look, Graham Potter's reputation improves by the week, really, because it's just a complete mess. Everything that came out of the club, you know, before and after Potter was sacked, about there being so many players they couldn't all fit in the dressing room at the training ground, that, you know, there being so many surplus players at training that they needed to create another nine-a-side game for the 18 players who weren't involved. It's ridiculous. And it's the last, you know, we've seen it happen many times in the Premier League era, where somebody's come in with loads of money into a club and they've gone at it like a kid in a sweet shop and just doing ridiculous things. You know, Man City are rightly praised for a lot of what they do, but Man City was a bit like that at the start after the Abu Dhabi money. Man City was certainly like that under Thaksin Shinawatra the previous year, QPR under Tony Fernandez. You know, there are so many examples of this. Everton under Mashiri, disastrous. year after year, just flailing around, no plan, just all transfers, shiny things, exciting players, players we've heard of. Wow, let's sign them. Chelsea's first year has been as mad, as irresponsible, and as reckless as anything I've ever seen, and I include Tony Fernandez's QPR in that. It's just been ridiculous. And it's,
to me, Ollie, I never seen, I mean, Tony Fernandez was buying different level players, right? And, you know, yeah, I think he brought in like 14 players 1 year under Mark Hughes. And when I look at Chelsea, they're not even competitive in games. I mean, I watched the Brighton game. They finished up 2-1, and it really should have been 7 or 8-1. I watched them against Arsenal, I watched them in other games. And I'm looking at this, and you said something that's quite important there. Graham Potter's reputation is improving by the week, and this is a real issue for another manager coming in there. Do I want to sacrifice my reputation for these people? Because here's the thing, Chelsea need to know why they're failing, and I'm not sure they do, right? And you're looking at, what can a manager really change at that football club when most of the players they bought are on 8-year contracts, so you can't get rid of them. You can't buy because of FFP, so you still need to sell. They're essentially a glorified coach because your authority's been usurped by people who know nothing about football. And I tweeted something back in July, and I said, Todd Boehly could easily be Chelsea's Ed Woodward. And Manchester United for a decade refused to listen to people that understood football. And it's not inevitable that this gets better, by the way. And these are people that are going to have to remove their ego from the club, which is not easy to do. That probably don't find fault with themselves as to why this is going wrong. If they listen to football people, the model has to completely change. There's Igbali, of course, who's also got to take responsibility for this. They're showing up at the training ground, watching training. You've got Todd Boehly coming out saying things about a all-star game and they're going to beat Real Madrid 4-0. I'm sure the players thanked him for that. And you've got players that don't feel like it's their fault. I can guarantee you they'll be, you know, what they were saying about Graham Potter, and, you know, we had to look him up on the internet and we're calling him Harry Potter and everything. As a Manchester United fan, I've seen this and over and over again. When you have no control parameters from the top, when a manager has no authority, and you're not in control of who comes in and who goes out, and you're sending players for the wrong reasons, this is a really, really hard mess to untangle. The difference is, United weren't sending players on 8-year contracts, and I'm looking at this going, the problems that I see at Chelsea aren't going to be fixed solely by a good manager. They might have some incremental improvement. They should, but Chelsea are a football club that are spending like they need to be in the top four, and I don't see that getting fixed anytime soon.
I would say I agree with everything you say about how deep the problems are, and the fact that they come from the top, the very top. I agree with the Ed Woodward comparison, which is not really something that a comparison that any new owner executive would want made of them. But it's, or Tony Fernandez or Farhad Moshiri, you know, it's these aren't the people you want to be compared to. But I would say, I think the first thing they need to do is, you know, we're already hearing talk about which players they will go for in the summer. Apart from the obvious need to buy a centre forward, I would say Chelsea will be a better team once they've got rid of 9 or 10 players. Once the younger players that they've bought and invested in have got room to breathe. You know, not just literally physically room to breathe in the changing room or in the corridor, but you know, room to develop and room to have the odd bad game. You know, Mudrik, who, look, ridiculously overpriced. He's hugely talented, but you don't spend that money on a player who's at Shakhtar Donetsk, who's had, you know, a couple of seasons. It's ludicrously overpriced, but there's talent there. But it's so hard for him to develop when there's like three or four players, senior players, vying for the same position. You can't have, and when the whole team is playing so poorly that the managers are just definitely, you know, Potter and now Lampard and whoever's in charge next season, they're just sort of desperately trying to change things, just in search of anything that will stick, anything that will work, just improve performance even for a, you know, for a half an hour. So if Mudryk and Fofana and all these players, Badiashile, young players who have come in, and it's just, you can't kind of learn on the job, because it's, there's always somebody ready to come off the bench. And there's, you look at how Arsenal did it with Saka and Martinelli, and Arteta just gave them games and games and games and games and just helped them to learn on the job. And it's not, you know, people talk about the number of exciting young talents Chelsea have signed. Well, great. But I remember Chelsea signing loads of exciting young talents under Abramovich, Kevin De Bruyne, Mo Salah, Romelu Lukaku. None of them made it at Chelsea because there was no patience and no pathway into the first team. They were just sort of, it was a scattergun recruitment policy, which got, you know, they did buy very good young players because of, you know, because that's the market they were shopping in, but they didn't have a plan for those players, and it showed. And I don't think, you know, they've got some really good sort of recruitment people in terms of scouting and connections and so on, but the big thing there needs to be is a strategy and a really clear vision of which of these players are they going to build around, which are they not going to build around. Because at the moment, I think it just sounds like they're going to be so desperate to sort of get players out that they're going to just sell whoever they can. Selling Mason Mount because, you know, because you've probably, you know, because you're in the final year of he's in the final year of his contract, and you're struggling to meet his demands when you've actually gone so much further than meeting the demands of so many other clubs and so many other players. It's a weird example to set in terms of, look, let's draw the line there, and let's show that we're not going to overpay for players. Well, if you're losing Mason Mount, who's, you know, one of your best homegrown players in decades, because you're trying to claw back money from the mistakes you've made earlier, then not great, is it?
Another team that has spent a lot without much in terms of results to show for it is Nottingham Forest. You know, they have fell to a 2-1 defeat to Brentford at the weekend, one of those games where it seems like everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong for Forest, who occupy the relegation zone. Oliver, what have you made of Forest's return to the top flight, and what do you think have been their biggest weaknesses, biggest reasons that make you think that they could potentially go down?
Well, in terms of, I mean, it's very similar to what we're talking about at Nottingham Forest, Chelsea. It's too many players. And I had this conversation with Forest fans at the start of the season, and they were saying, yeah, you don't understand. We've come up with all these loan players or players who are out of contract. We need to sign all these players. And I'm thinking, well, no, you need to sign lots of players. You don't need to sign 28 players. You don't need to sign three left wing backs. Man City have barely had I think Man City won a Premier League last season without a left back in the window, a left back in the whole club. That's a club that's playing sort of 60 odd games because they're going to the wire in all the cup competitions. They're going all the way or semi-finals in Europe. Forest, which, you know, they didn't really get far in the cups. They took about 43, 44 games. If you're signing players who you've done your homework and you know what they're like physically, and you're not buying injured players, and that has been an issue for Forest. You don't need a squad of 25 players if you're playing, you know, 40 odd games. You shouldn't need it. So yes, they needed players, but their transfer windows, their two transfer windows, even January, it's just mad. It just looks like right, we'll sign him. And then, but we've been offered him. Oh, so we'll sign him. I remember doing that on Championship Manager when I was a kid. You sign players because, well, he's available. Oh, we'll do that as well. And then we'll deal with that once we've got him. And I mean, they're actually in a really good situation. If you'd said to their fans and not their chairman, because he clearly thought they were going to finish in the top 10, but probably top six. If you said to their fans, look, with four games remaining, you're going to be level with Leicester, Leeds, and ahead of Everton and Southampton. Probably one more win, four more points, something like that will do it. I think their fans would have thought that was a fantastic result. And look, it has been in some ways because Steve Cooper has had to deal with this situation the same as Chelsea have, where you've simply got too many players. You've got, and it's got to be, and you lose, they've won 7 games out of 34, which I think is an achievement because they've not got great players. They've got loads of players, but they've not got many players that you would have thought would be up to that level in the Premier League. And it's so hard when you've got so many players, and it can't be good for team spirit, and it can't be good for cohesion in terms of tactical, in terms of trying to build it and build things and build relationships on the pitch, and having to adapt from playing, very front foot last season to being much more on the defensive this season because they've been dominated a lot of the time by better teams. I think Cooper has done a brilliant job. And I've absolutely no doubt at all there have been stages throughout the season where Marinakis was desperate to sack him because he can't leave it alone. He can't, he goes against the grain with him. You look at what he's done with Olympiakos over the years. He's always sacking coaches. I think it was his instinct to sack Cooper in about September, and thankfully he was talked out of it or saw sense. And I think if Forest stay up, it's going to be because of excuse me. I think if Forest stay up, it's going to be because of Steve Cooper. He's an extremely good coach. He's done a fantastic job. If they stay up by a point, he's done a brilliant job. If they go down by a point, he's still done a brilliant job, and he will be the reason they end up with as many points as they do, rather than the reason they didn't end up with more points.
Do you think there's a general sentiment amongst Forest fans that they'd rather go down with Cooper than stay up with another manager?
I one of my best mates is a Forest fan. He said his view has always been, I'd rather go down with Cooper than stay up with say a Sam Allardyce or even Rafa Benitez or whoever, those whoever might come in if it was more of a sort of troubleshooter manager. But he confessed about a week or two ago that the closer it gets, the idea of dropping out of the Premier League, he's loved it. He's loved going to all the big grounds with his son, taking him to Anfield the other week, taking him to Chelsea and Spurs, Man United, Arsenal, all the big grounds and going away, and it's been fantastic. Even though I think if they only won one away, I think, or their away record hasn't been great, but he's loved the whole Premier League experience. But he did confess that if it came down to it, he would just fear for the financial consequences of the club for the club if they're relegated, because they've massively overspent. They've overspent in the belief that it would keep them up.
Last couple of questions, Ollie. I really appreciate it. I want to evolve the conversation over to Tottenham because when we talk about football clubs in crisis, I'm trying to understand what Tottenham's strategy is. Daniel Levy has been credited over the years of being quite shrewd in the transfer market. Now, depends who you talk to, people will tell you he is quite removed from the day-to-day operations of the football club. Spurs fans want him out. They hold him accountable for what's going on. I've looked at their last couple appointments, Mourinho. Of course, they appointed Nuno. They appointed Conte, and I'm trying to understand how Mourinho and Conte fit with Spurs. Now, Conte turned the top down, first of all, then took it. And when I look at what Spurs' strategy is buying young players, developing them, that's not an Antonio Conte model. That's not a Jose Mourinho model. I'm trying to understand who's coming up with these decisions, not hiring someone like Erik ten Hag when he is that type of manager that would invest in young players and develop them, which he's done at Ajax. I'm trying to understand who's connecting the dots here at Tottenham and looking at this and going, let's go for a Conte, let's go for Mourinho. Both have very predictable outcomes. And then let's go into the transfer market and buy a bunch of young players. Now, I'm not sure Antonio Conte has enough right to complain the way he did. I mean, Spurs were always being Spurs. They did exactly what they've always done. I'm not sure why he expected much different. He turned the job down for a good reason the first time. But I'm looking at this going, who is identifying these managers and saying they fit with the developmental model? Because they clearly don't.
Yeah, well, I think an awful lot of the time it has been Daniel Levy. And they have been popular appointments. I think Spurs fans were generally quite on board with, I mean, there'll be exceptions, but were generally on board with the idea of...
But were they on board, Ollie, because they were expecting something different when they hired those guys, in the sense that, okay, we're not going to have a developmental model, we're going to buy stars that obviously suit what we should expect with a Mourinho and a Conte model? Or I mean, maybe they were expecting something different, that Spurs were going to behave differently because Conte took the job, maybe was made promises that Spurs should be different. I don't know. Sorry.
I agree with you on the complete sort of disconnect between the idea of being the idea of buying young players, which they've continued to do, people like Sessegnon and Jed Spence and Kulusevski and Brian Hill, who's young, still young, Romero, Porro. They bought young players, and Mourinho and Conte, they both like to buy players who are and work with players who are battle-hardened. So like Perisic and like, you know, Højbjerg, you know, he's not ancient, but he's a sort of battle-hardened player. That's the kind of players they like. So there's been just in terms of profile, never mind playing style or anything like that, it's a complete contradiction, isn't it? I found that very strange. And I think Spurs, having made those appointments, didn't really embrace the type of manager that they had. And I don't think those managers could ever be claimed to have really embraced the type of club or the type of project that they had. So, yeah, all predictable outcomes. But it was interesting. There was a thing that my colleagues, Charlie Eccleshare and Jack Pitbrook, wrote on Spurs about the squad, about the size of the squad and the age profile of the squad, which I found absolutely fascinating. Which, you know, we've got this sort of three or four year window per position, which is deemed to be peak age. So it will be, you know, for strikers and central defenders, it's sort of mid to late 20s to about 30 or something like that. And there were only, I think, seven players within this vast Spurs squad, which includes the players out on loan, who were deemed to be within this sort of 3-year period of peak age. And they are, I'm looking at it now, Davinson Sanchez, Sergio Reguilón, Emerson Royale, Yves Bissouma, Tanguy Ndombele, Rodrigo Bentancur, and Giovanni Lo Celso. Now, most of those players are out on loan.
Can he not fall in that category?
He's 29. He's deemed to be outside of that sort of peak category in terms of... maybe he's defying it, but it's the point is there are all those players in a sort of what should be the best years of their career. They're either playing poorly or they're out on loan because the manager didn't fancy them, which also serves as a reminder where you've got younger players like Romero, Porro, Sessegnon, Spence, Skip, Kulusevski, Hill. It tells you that this is a club where players haven't really developed over the last few years under Mourinho and under Conte and briefly under Nuno, but players haven't gone to Spurs and improved. So you've got all these players who are coming up to peak years in theory, which is good, but are they going to improve at Tottenham? I think the only way they will improve at Tottenham is if they get the type of manager who is going to improve players. And I find it bizarre, really, that they appear to be on the brink of letting Pochettino go to Chelsea. I think he'd be perfect for Spurs. Whether Spurs would be perfect for him second time around, I don't know. But I would think from Spurs' point of view, the prospect of a second, a remarriage with Mourinho, Pochettino would make a lot of sense.
Oliver, I wanted to ask you about a report from your Athletic colleague, Mario Cortajana, where he talks about Jude Bellingham to Real Madrid being not a done deal, but closer than ever. We had the chance to speak to Harry Redknapp about Bellingham, how he'd fit in at Real Madrid. But I'm curious, it does seem like an interesting career path going from Birmingham City in the Championship to Borussia Dortmund in the Bundesliga to probably the most successful club in football history. What do you think about this potential move for Bellingham?
I think it's a great move for him. I think it's a brilliant move for him. You said probably the most successful club in football. I think it has been the most successful club in terms of, well, certainly in terms of European football, in terms of all those European Cups, all those Spanish League titles. They are the biggest club in the world. I know other clubs might say that, but by whatever metric, Real Madrid are bigger. And I've not always had a great admiration for the way they've done their business in terms of transfers and in terms of recruitment, but been really impressed by what they've done the last 5 years in terms of rebuilding that fantastic multiple Champions League winning squad and getting in Vinicius at such a young age, Rodrigo at a young age, Odegaard, they got him in, didn't develop him the way they developed the others, but that's one that didn't quite work out. Eder Militao, and now Camavinga, Tchouameni, and presumably Bellingham. It probably sounds easy to cherry pick the best young players in world football, but they've done it really well. They've bought them early, perhaps less early in terms of career path, in terms of in the case of Bellingham, because you're getting somebody who's already so established and so expensive, but it's been a really impressive way that they've done it. And even though Camavinga and Tchouameni have gone into a midfield team which has got Kroos and Modric, and still had Casemiro last Robert season, the evolution of the team has been such that they have been given a lot of football and given the chance to develop exactly the kind of thing that I was saying Chelsea aren't doing. That they've bought players without even a short-term, medium-term plan for them, whereas Real Madrid have bought, while working with a fairly small squad in terms of the numbers, have bought players who are able to go in there and either play first team, become first team regulars straight away, or just to spend a year or two being groomed as the successor. Camavinga learning from Casemiro and Tchouameni, and they've all been learning from Kroos and Modric. It's the right way to do it.
Proper succession.
And Bellingham, the idea of Bellingham being in a midfield for the next 10 years with Camavinga and Tchouameni and with Valverde and Rodrigo and Vinicius and who knows who else, probably Haaland or Mbappe at some point. I think Real Madrid, I don't know, I think it's clearly a you know, a great place to play, and he's Bellingham is, you know, sometimes you would worry about a young English player moving abroad and moving overseas, different culture, different language, different way of playing football, but he's left Birmingham at 16, 17, been so mature in Germany, you know, no real issues at all in terms of his off-field adaption, on-field adaption, old head on young shoulders. I think he'll do exceptionally well there. And I can understand why a lot of people were saying, well, Liverpool would be perfect for him in terms of, you know, being maybe more of a core player, you know, maybe being more of a star at Liverpool than he would be at Real Madrid, you know, in terms of role within the team. But I think if you're a regular starter for Real Madrid, you are a star. And weighing up that versus potentially playing in the Europa League next season for a Liverpool team who are rebuilding,
yeah,
I think it's a fairly easy decision, really.
Last question, Ollie. I want to hold the conversation up to what we saw last week with Jurgen Klopp, where it provoked a lot of discussion about behaviour of referees, behaviour of people on the sideline towards referees. Of course, we also had the issue with Andy Robertson had to deck us not so long ago. And it's not a new discussion. I mean, we've seen managers do this quite a bit where they break the fourth official. I understand the emotion involved. And I understand both sides of the argument, because as a football fan, I've been frustrated at times with the misuse of VAR and some blatantly obvious decisions not being given. Then the next day or even the same day in a completely different game, that decision is given. And I'm not talking about the nuanced subjective ones. I'm talking about some of the most blatant decisions that for 100 years have been a handball, but now they're not a handball. For 100 years it's been an offside, but now it's not an offside. And they're constantly refining the rules to a point where I feel it doesn't help either the manager, the fans, or the referee, because, you know, it really does leave it so much down to interpretation. And it's taken the black and white out of it, where, you know, it's down to opinion. And we're seeing wildly different swings every week. And, of course, this provokes managers' angers. I mean, we saw with Spurs and Brighton, which was just unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And every fan feels like referees cheat against their team. How do we solve this chasm? Because it seems like it's becoming a bigger and bigger issue where fans have very little trust in the officiating. You know, we always hear about examples being given to younger referees and younger coaches about not attacking referees, and Graham Potter handled it with such class when Chelsea were denied a clear penalty, in my opinion. How do we bridge this divide? Is it about going back to the authorities and saying, look, we don't need the nuance of rules to this degree. We need to have them a little bit simpler, so that we're not getting these wildly inconsistent decisions being given, and we can, you know, have some rapport between managers and referees again.
Yeah, I think for one thing, the game has become so fast the last,
yeah, that's true,
10, 20 years, but it gets faster and faster. I mean, there's you know, data that backs that up. I think that makes the referee's job harder, undoubtedly. I think players are less honest than they've ever been. I think cheating and going down with contact, exaggerating contact, but also initiating contact have become so normalized and so ingrained in people's behavior. I mean, it's when a player initiates a foul and goes down for it, you know, as journalists or as fans or whatever, we tend to have a go at the player who dives. But players generally go after the referee. That you very rarely get player, you know, it's almost like honor amongst thieves. That, you know, because everyone does it, no, it's almost like nobody really begrudges a player diving. And that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous that football allowed exaggeration, simulation, diving, whatever, to become so ingrained in what everyone does. Football never tried to tackle it. It's just sort of almost turned a blind eye, and that's a massive problem. Look, the speed is a good thing, but it makes refs harder, ref jobs harder. The dishonesty is a bad thing, which makes which makes their job harder, and nobody seems to really made any effort to prevent that happening. In terms of the actual standard of refereeing, I think a lot of the time, 90% of the time, I really sympathize with referees, and I think they have an absolutely thankless job, and I think it's vile when people accuse them of corruption or bias or, you know, total incompetence, when a lot of the decisions are really marginal, or at least there are shades of grey within it. Some of the decisions are harder to understand, but I don't think we have a crisis in the standard of refereeing. I think the crisis is in how vague the rules are in some cases, and how, in terms of handball and offside, how it's just like changes from one season to the next. I mean, some of the, I just don't know, I don't understand the endless tweaks to the handball rule and the offside rule, because they, I mean, 3 or 4 years ago, I think the rules now are better than they were in terms of the offside, the handball, the rules are better now than in that time, sort of 3 or 4 years ago, when VAR was just brought in, and there were just penalties being awarded constantly for, you know, just a ball just hitting somebody on the upper arm or whatever. The Champions League final with Sissoko for Tottenham against Liverpool, that was, you know, it was ludicrous. Never mind the fact that it was in the first minute. But it's, so I welcome the divergence from that kind of zero tolerance approach to the ball hitting somebody on the arm, but it's just the endless tweaks and the endless things about, you know, coming down to interpretation.
Yeah.
You know, if you're talking about moving away from the grey area, which means things being black and white, you're almost saying, well, okay, do we have no contact at all? And I think, well, that's just mad, having no contact at all. But I just think the fact that the threshold of what's a foul and what's a handball and what's offside, the fact that it just changes constantly has just led to such misunderstanding and confusion, not least among referees and VARs and linesmen. And it's just, I think it used to sound like a real admission of weakness to say, oh, I'm not sure what the rules are anymore. But how do you keep track?
I'll tell you where this is an issue also, although it doesn't make TV. These rules get communicated to the Premier League and get communicated to people in professional football.
Mm.
And they get communicated to referees. But where they don't get communicated is at lower levels. So when you see in a Sunday league some guy screaming at a referee for giving an offside that they're not aware is now offside, but it wasn't last year. You know, this creates unbelievable chaos, and it creates huge problems at youth football, because referees are refereeing almost a different game at this level. It's not the same as the top level, and they keep creating these nuanced rules that aren't taken into consideration, that most football is not played at the highest level with all this technology.
No.
And trying to ask referees at lower levels to officiate along the same lines is asking for trouble, because you know what it's like. You see managers on sidelines on Sunday league or youth football are screaming at referees, and they're going, wait a minute, what do you mean that's not an offside? What do you mean that's not a handball? No one told me yet. You know, and you know, to me, I just think it's so, I didn't mean to cut you off, unnecessarily complicated, because it just, some things just don't need to happen. But anyway, people will never fix this problem. Zach, you got anything else before I let Lolly go?
Oliver, just one last question. I wanted to ask you about Lionel Messi being suspended by 2 weeks by Paris Saint-Germain after taking an unauthorized trip to Saudi Arabia. It does seem like Messi's time at Paris Saint-Germain is going to end in disappointment. What have you made of his spell at the Parc des Princes, and what do you think is next for Messi at this point in his career?
I thought it was sad when he went there in the first place. I thought he just should be somebody who spent his whole career at Barcelona. It seemed perfect. And I feel that it's just been regrettable, his time in Paris. I mean, he won the French League last season. He will probably win it again, despite they seem to be doing their best to try and throw it away. He'll probably win it again, but it will be under a cloud because he's been suspended by the club and for visiting Saudi Arabia for an ambassadorial trip when he was meant to be at training. It just seems like a kind of, I get slightly frustrated when people dismiss the PSG project and saying, look, it's a complete laughing stock. It's become that the last 3 years or 2 or 3 years, but it wasn't that. It wasn't that. They were building something, compelling within the constraints of Ligue 1, but they were one of the best teams in Europe for most of the past decade. And the last couple of years, it's just become this circus, really. And I think adding Messi to a forward line, which already had Neymar and Mbappe and was hard to manage, and the superstar dynamic was hard to manage, and then signing Ramos and, all these sort of superstar additions that they didn't particularly need. It just felt like they were kind of thinking glitz and glamour and all-star, commercial status, etc., rather than a proper football project. And this is something I've written about on The Athletic, while basically just ignoring the incredible, unrivaled talent that has been emerging in Paris over the last 10 years. So I find it depressing that Messi has ended up being, part of what has diminished the PSG project, and in doing so, they've not really diminished him, because look, what is anybody going to look back and remember from the final years of Messi's career? They're going to remember the World Cup and his fantastic role in doing that. I think when people are reminiscing, and I know I'll do a lot of that about Messi's career, I think the PSG years will barely get a mention. I think, he scored some unbelievable goals, unbelievable assists playing for PSG. But guess what? He did all of that in even greater numbers in Barcelona, when it really felt like it meant something, when it led to glory, success, trophies. I think the PSG thing has just been, it seemed like a sellout at the time when he left, but it wasn't particularly his sellout, because he was leaving Barcelona against his wishes because they'd been mismanaged. But I think moving to Saudi Arabia on top of that would undoubtedly seem like a sellout, the same way it does with Ronaldo. If he goes to MLS, that would probably seem like a bit of a sellout. I just wish he'd stayed at Barcelona. From an English football fan, English football journalist point of view, I would have loved him to play in the Premier League. But from a more global, less parochial point of view, I really liked the purity of the idea of him staying in Barcelona. And I really wish he'd done that, because I'm not having anybody saying it's ruined his legacy or whatever. No. That's just complete nonsense. Nobody talks about, Pelé, but what about his spell at the New York Cosmos? What about, Maradona's spell at Sevilla? Look, the thing is, ultimately, even though Messi's remained playing at a high level at PSG, but all anybody will remember of his post-Barcelona career really is that fantastic contribution to the World Cup, which moved me and enthralled me in Qatar a few months ago, whereas basically his time in Paris has just left me cold.
No, listen, he was a gift from the gods, Ollie. I mean, if you're a football fan, you just have to... Even when he was tearing United apart from that Barcelona team, it was, you know, you just have to admire the genius of him. He's just sad that all these things come to an end, and it always seemed to end the same way, where, you know, that decline is always hard to take. But we'll see what happens. Mate, you've been such a gentleman. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to myself and Zach on the podcast. And take care of yourself, and we'll get you back again soon. I'm sure you're delighted to hear that.
I'll try and find a better backdrop for next time.
It's all right, mate.
We're having renovations. It's a struggle to find a room without workmen in it. So, I've been there.
I thought this is where you film your OnlyFans.
Sorry, I should... My reaction then should be, what's OnlyFans?
I don't know. Zach was telling me about it. Okay. Thank you very much, mate. Much appreciated. Cheers, mate. All right. See you, mate. Bye.
Good thing. Cheers.